and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Julie Gourley, Senior Arctic Official of the United States and U.S. Representative to the Arctic Council. Her talk on the Arctic Council, promoting cooperation, coordination, and interaction among the Arctic states, was recorded at a joint meeting of the Institute of the North and Commonwealth North on August 18th. Learn more about the brief history and future of the Arctic Council next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans after the news. This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans. This week's program was recorded at a joint meeting of the Institute of the North and Commonwealth North, held at the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage on August 18th.
Let me tell you a little bit about the program itself. Julie's going to talk about the Arctic Council and new directions. I've heard Mead Treadwell say a number of times, and I parrot him whenever I have the opportunity, that it's Alaska that makes the United States an Arctic country. So the new excitement about the Arctic that's happening in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, frankly, is driven by the fact that our state is the Arctic for the United States. And so we're particularly pleased by the fact that the U.S. State Department realizes that the person in charge of the council's activities needs to have a firsthand understanding of Alaska and the people that in some way she's representing at the council. So Julie Gourley is our senior Arctic official, affectionately known as a sow, but she doesn't flinch. And the senior Arctic officials, she's going to give us a broad overview of the Arctic Council, of the recent changes, continuing programs, and new initiatives of this group that, frankly, is taking on new dimensions with every ministerial, and particularly with the Nuuk ministerial and the presence of the United States, which she'll be talking about. The program today is part of the Institute's Week of the Arctic. When Julie has finished, I think you'll have a better understanding of Alaska's connection to the complex and global processes of the Arctic. I want to thank Commonwealth North for co-hosting the program today, and UIC for sponsoring this event and for being a sponsor of the Week of the Arctic. And we will have time for Q&A. At the head table, on my far right, Price Brower, who's the UIC board chairman, and as I said, they're an event sponsor. Thank you very much. And Tim Whitking, just to my right, is a Commonwealth North board member, and I'd like to thank you for co-hosting the event, and you always thank do you. Such a wonderful job. Thank you very much. And then, of course, we have our sow, Julie Gourley. Julie is the senior Arctic official of the United States, and she is the U.S. representative to the Arctic Council, and she leads our delegations. She handles the State Department's Arctic portfolio, covering the wide range of U.S. foreign policy interests in the Arctic. Prior to her current assignment in the Office of Ocean and Polar Affairs, Julie spent 5 years in the State Department's Office of Environmental Policy. Her portfolio covered hazardous waste and chemicals treaties, including the Basel Convention, the Rotterdam Convention, and the Montreal Protocol, whatever those are. And she came to the State Department from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, where she spent 12 years covering chemicals issues, hazardous waste, trade, and domestic climate change programs. So she's really well suited to be doing this Arctic work and dealing with the issues in the Arctic. Before government service, Julie spent several years at both the Urban Institute and the National Council for Urban Economic Development. She concentrated on domestic urban issues. She has a Bachelor's of Science in Geography with a concentration in urban and regional planning from Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. I met Julie when she became our senior Arctic official, and I was still at the Department of Interior. And what was great about meeting Julie was I met a woman who had a smile on her face and a bounce in her step and who clearly loved the job. And she really embraced it. She's very intellectually curious. She drills down. She asks the right questions. She wants to better understand the nexus between we Alaskans and our great state and her role in managing the federal government's membership in the Arctic. So I'm really very honored and very pleased to introduce to you our senior Arctic official, Julie Gourley.
Drew, that was way too nice. So thank you for that really nice introduction. And I am so pleased to be here to see Alaska again. I think this is unfortunately only my fourth time up here since I've had this had the privilege of having this great job. But every time I come up here, I just am amazed at how everyone hangs together. Everyone knows everyone. Everyone knows what's going on up here. It's a very knowledgeable populace. Probably, I would argue that the population of Alaska knows more about its own state than the population of any other state in the Union. So it's a very impressive place. And I've been up to Barrow and to Fairbanks, and that's the extent of it. So I need to, as part of my trips up here and getting to know the state, need to get out a little bit more. And I hope to do that in the coming months and years. So I thought I would give you a little bit of an overview on what the Arctic Council is for people who don't know much about it. A lot of people in this room do know what it is and are very familiar with it. But I thought I would just take you through a little bit of what it's about, kind of a one-on-one, and then get into more of the detail about what the Council is doing right now and where it's heading. So it was founded in 1996. It grew out of something called the Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy, which was created in 1991. It is the only high-level diplomatic forum devoted 100% to the Arctic. Excuse me. The membership is limited. It's closed, essentially, to the eight countries that have land territory above the Arctic Circle. So it's, as you see there, Canada, Denmark, because of Greenland, Finland, Iceland, Norway, Russia, Sweden, and the United States, because of you. And what's kind of unique about it in a different way, not only is it the only circumpolar forum that's totally dedicated to the Arctic, but it's also the only forum in the world, really, that has indigenous representation sitting right next to the governments. And indigenous peoples run the entity alongside all of us. The Aleut International Association, the Arctic Athabaskan Council, the Gwich'in Council International, and the Inuit Circumpolar Council all have representation in Alaska. They are four of the six permanent participant groups. The other two are the Sami Council, which is in Scandinavia and Western Russia, and then the Russian Association of Indigenous Peoples of the North, which covers only Russian indigenous groups, indigenous peoples. But combined, all six of them cover the large majority of indigenous peoples living in the Arctic, and they participate very actively in the organization, and we really couldn't function without them. They're the people on the ground who know what's going on, who live there. It's incredibly important and very, very, very valuable to have governments sitting together with indigenous peoples to cover the range of things going on in the Arctic. They're also, structurally, the council's made up of the foreign ministers, and below them, organizationally, are the senior Arctic officials, one from each of the eight countries. And then there are, below that, six working groups that do the work, the actual substantive work of the council, and I'll get into those a little bit in a minute. Then in recent years, in just the last 3 years, we've tried a kind of a new take on some of the discrete projects the council does by setting up task forces and expert groups. And I'll, I think, get into that a little bit more as well. So the council meets every 2 years at the culmination of whichever country is chairing it. It met most recently in May at the foreign minister level in Nuuk, Greenland. Probably a lot of you heard about that meeting. And it was, as I said, it was the end of the Danish chairmanship, and at that moment, the Swedish government took over, and now Sweden will hold the chairmanship for the next 2 years until 2013. And it was the first time ever, strangely enough, that the U.S. has actually sent its foreign minister. to the council. So Secretary Clinton was there, and it was very, very good for the United States to have her there, and I think it showed, kind of put the last nail in the coffin of the critics who think the United States for all these last 15 years hasn't been serious about the council and about our role as an Arctic nation, which isn't true. We've always cared and been very, very engaged in the council. We've done the majority of the most important, we've led the majority of the most important projects in the council. We've funded it, we've used our people. We've always been very engaged, but the leadership at the top has not been so engaged until now. But Secretary Clinton is very, very interested in the Arctic, and she was thrilled to be there. And just to show how serious she was, she also took Interior Secretary Salazar with her, Senator Murkowski, and Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, who unfortunately isn't here today. But it was a very powerful, high-level delegation, and I think we won't hear any complaints that the U.S. isn't serious about the Arctic anymore. At least I hope not. One of the big things we did from an institutional standpoint in Nuuk was to create a permanent secretariat for the entity. I should step back a minute and say that the Arctic Council is not an international organization like the OECD or like the UN. It's not. There's no institution around it. There's no headquarters building. No permanent staff. But and that's in part due to some of the member states not wanting to go in that direction, feeling like the council as an intergovernmental forum works really well. It's a lot less formal. It's a friendlier environment for Russia in particular. It's been working well. That's not to say there aren't problems with that model, permanent funding being one of them. But what we decided to do to give it a little bit more stability, especially when the chairmanship rotates among the member states, is a permanent secretariat. So we now do have a small little institutional structure that supports the council. The council remains an intergovernmental forum with no institutional structure. But the permanent secretariat that we created and will be housed in Tromsø, Norway, is going to be have an institutional structure. And that's largely for practical reasons, so that if the council needs to contract out work or have other kinds of services provided, we now have a place with a legal personality that can do that, which has never existed before. So that's an improvement, I think. All of us are very happy to finally have some stability and institutional memory, at least in the administrative function of the council. It will, of course, operate the website, do public outreach, field calls from the media, things like that. It will be a strictly administrative structure and small and lean. It's not going to be a big monster entity like you see in UN secretariats. It won't have any policy-making role. But it should be very helpful to all of us governments who have to take on the chairmanship every 2 years, and in so doing until now, had to provide secretariat services. And when we had the chairmanship for the first time in 1998 to 2000, in the State Department, we begged and pleaded to have employees from other federal agencies come on detail to us to perform secretariat services and to help staff our chairmanship. And now that won't be so so complicated, because we'll have this permanent secretariat. Another thing we did institutionally to strengthen the council, some would argue it hasn't strengthened it yet, but will someday, is to create criteria for how we determine which non-Arctic entities should have permanent observership in the council. And there are a number of countries and other organizations that want to come in and have observer status. They can't join as members, but they can have observer status in the council. And the four countries pending right now are China, Japan, South Korea, and Italy. The European Union also wants observership, as do a couple of NGOs, the International Oil and Gas Producers Association, Oceania, and an indigenous working group that is part of the Barents Euro-Arctic Council, which is a regional Arctic entity. So some of these applications for observership have been pending for a long time. And we've been struggling since the beginning of the Norwegian chairmanship in 2006, to figure out what to do with this growing interest in the Arctic, and this, more specifically, a growing interest in the Arctic Council. And it's not been been an easy discussion, but what we did finally come to agreement on is criteria, sort of concrete criteria we can use to all of us in our capitals to determine if someone who wants in can and should really be in, has really actual institutional or national interests in the Arctic. So what I also wanted to do is talk a little bit about a particularly important initiative that came out of the council and was finalized in May at the ministerial meeting that Secretary Clinton attended. And probably many of you in this room, maybe everyone has heard about this already. What we did was finalize and have the foreign minister sign the first ever legally binding agreement among the eight Arctic countries, and it's on search and rescue cooperation. The council itself, this is a little bit of a subtlety. The Arctic Council, because it's an intergovernmental forum, has no regulatory authority. It doesn't make law. It doesn't make treaties. So what it did do, though, and this is kind of a fine point, is serve as the entity that brought the eight states together who, on their own, negotiated this search and rescue treaty. So it's a treaty among the eight Arctic states, but it's not an Arctic Council treaty per se. But what it did, and this is a map that shows the search and rescue regions that the agreement codified, what this does is formalize the cooperation on search and rescue among the eight countries. So we thought it was timely to do this because there's so much human activity happening and much more every day in the Arctic, as you all well know better than anyone. There are cruise ships going up there. There are going to be oil tankers. There will be more fishing vessels. There will be more kinds of shipping all around, all kinds of economic development activities. So with more people, there's more risk, of course, for accidents and life-threatening accidents. So what we thought was important to do was formalize a structure that's really already in place and has been forever. So all of the Arctic states now are legally bound to help each other in when needed, when called upon for search and rescue activities. And the way we sort of split the pie, if you will, of the Arctic was through these search and rescue regions, which are based largely on the maritime search and rescue regions under the IMO and the aeronautical search and rescue regions under the International Civil Aviation Organization. So the lines didn't match up, and some of the lines actually had never been ratified by the governments that had the boundary. So this exercise formalized all the boundaries in the Arctic and aligned the aeronautical and maritime lines so that we have one set of areas that each country has the lead in. So in the Russian region, as you see there, it's the biggest one. Russia has the lead. And so if something happens in their search and rescue region and they need help, they know now who to call in the United States or in Canada or in Denmark or wherever to get help. As I said, it's the first binding agreement among the Arctic states. The negotiation of it was very positive. The task force that was set up to negotiate this thing was co-chaired by the United States and Russia, which was a very fortunate pairing, I would say, because the Arctic, is still to this day thought of as sort of the theater of the Cold War between our two countries. And yet we came together, the two of us, and helped to shepherd the negotiation of this binding treaty in the Arctic itself. So it was a really good symbolic thing, in addition to the fact that functionally it worked very well. The U.S. and Russia worked very well together, and the other Arctic states were extremely collaborative. The Coast Guards were the leads mostly for all of the Arctic states, and they all worked together well anyway. But that made this an even easier negotiation. So it only took 1 year from the first meeting to the last to actually negotiate the treaty. It was very, very fast. It covers a huge amount of area, almost 3 million square miles. And it was signed officially into existence at the Nuuk Ministerial. And this is a picture of Secretary Clinton being handed the document by Sean Morton, who is with the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade in Canada, who got the lucky job of going around to each foreign minister and having them sign. He's one of the lawyers who played in the negotiations. So, as I said, it's based on IMO and ICAO existing treaties and agreements and lines. Some of the pieces of it here, some of the articles listed here reflect the exact text, I think, what the key parts of the agreement do. The last one, Article 9, is kind of the broad sweeping one, generally promoting cooperation among the parties on search and rescue in the Arctic. And I don't know if the agreement is actually online yet. It probably will be at some point and I can certainly get copies to anyone who wants to see it. We have it. It's a single document in English, French, and Russian, so it's very fat, but it's really not a very big agreement. It's just there are three things all bound up together. So moving on from SAR, which is the first really big thing we've done, the first treaty we've ever done in the under the auspices of the Arctic Council, some of the other big work that we've been doing of late include a snow, water, ice, and permafrost assessment, so an assessment of the cryosphere. That was somewhat of a follow-on to the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment that we did back in 2004. It's a newer piece, set of information, but you know, assessments are a snapshot in time, so they become outdated rather quickly. But at least it was the state of the science as of a few months ago. Probably at some point we'll update it many years down the road if there's an interest in doing that. Some of the questions that it left unanswered, but that came out in the course of assessing the cryosphere, as you see here, are what will happen to the Arctic Ocean and its ecosystems as fresh water starts coming in, or is already coming in. How quickly could the Greenland ice sheet melt? This seems like the figures on that change almost every day. And how will the Arctic cryosphere affect the global climate system, and how will these changes affect Arctic societies? So it was a very comprehensive look at the cryosphere, but just at the cryosphere, not at the larger picture of the Arctic. And there's a little more work coming in that regard that I'll talk about in a few minutes. We also, back in 2009, at that ministerial meeting at the culmination of the Norwegian chairmanship, and which took place during the Danish chairmanship, had a special task force to focus on short-lived climate forcers, which are an emerging issue in the global climate debate. The particular three that are thought to affect the Arctic most intensely are black carbon, methane, and tropospheric ozone, which black carbon is a fancy word for soot, methane is a fancy word for natural gas, and tropospheric ozone is a fancy word for smog. And methane and smog being very, very closely related. But what we did, we initiated this task force again, the United States, and we co-chaired it with Norway, was bring together technical and economic experts from the Arctic states to look at what, if anything, all of the Arctic states are doing to regulate domestically particulate matter, including black carbon, and to get a handle on, supported by the AMAP working group, on the science underpinning the effects of black carbon in the Arctic. And that was that piece of it, the scientific modeling that happened in support of this task force, was very cutting edge. No one has really looked, certainly no one has looked at the Arctic yet, for impacts specifically of black carbon on the cryosphere. So there was some very good cutting edge modeling done in support of the recommendations of this task force, which were essentially to seek voluntary mitigation of black carbon sources, emission sources across the Arctic. And the eight Arctic states are not the only set of countries that emit black carbon that affects the Arctic. The latest science seems to indicate that weather patterns move black carbon into the Arctic from down as low as the 40th parallel. So that would include northern China, Eastern Europe, and other places outside the Arctic. But what we wanted to do with this task force was see if we could succeed in getting voluntary mitigation of black carbon amongst ourselves, and if so, in a way that is economically feasible. If so, carry that model into other parts of the world where black carbon is an issue, like in the Himalayan countries, where the Himalayan glaciers are important sources of drinking water for a lot of those countries. So. And it was successful in that it took an emerging climate issue and took it out of the global climate debate, which, as everyone here knows, is completely politically chaotic. The Framework Convention on Climate Change is something that we've been trying to join for a long time and haven't been successful. But outside of that, I don't think anyone in the United States government wants to ignore that there are things we can do outside that the Framework Convention. So this was an opportunity to see if we can take some action that hopefully, if we all work together and domestically take action, will buy us some time in slowing down the melting of the cryosphere. And the science is still very much out there. It's not unified at all. There's a lot of scientific uncertainty with the impacts of black carbon in the Arctic. But this work was very important to bringing it into the public debate and to energizing the scientific community to look a little bit more closely at the impacts of black carbon. So the major mitigation sectors are transportation, especially diesel engines, residential heating, open burning, shipping, wildfires, so forth. Another big piece of work the Council is doing that the Department of Interior is very, through the Fish and Wildlife Service, is very involved in is this an Arctic biodiversity assessment. And the first piece of that came out last year, Arctic Biodiversity Trends. It was a trends report that, and this is the, we had it translated into Russian, so we thought we'd show the Russian language cover of it. It's identical to the English language. Some of the key findings listed here, the news is not all bad, as we found. Unique habitats are disappearing, but the majority of species are stable or increasing, even though some are declining. Long-term observations are required. The Sustaining Arctic Observing Network is figuring in there, which I'll get into in a minute. And climate change is the most significant stressor, but other things like contaminants and habitat fragmentation, development, and so forth are having impacts in the Arctic biological diversity situation. Some of the ongoing work of the Council, those are kind of sort of the big things that are coming down the pike, but now some of the ongoing work that is happening that's also very important is the Sustainable Development Working Group that Karen Perdue, who is sitting right here in the front, used to be our representative for many, many years and did a fantastic job. I'm glad she's here. During her leadership in that working group was instrumental in setting up a human health experts group, which there's kind of two kinds of human health work going on in the Council. One is in the AMAP working group, which is looking at human health issues related to contaminants mostly. And sort of the biochemical side of things. The human health experts group that Karen was very instrumental in creating looks more at the human health picture from the more traditional things we think about, lifestyle issues, disease transmission throughout the Arctic, things like that. So these two groups in these two subgroups of these two working groups in the Council are working together quite well, and we're getting a lot of really, really good work done in the Arctic on human health. So it's been really a very rewarding thing to watch happen. The short-lived climate forcers work on black carbon, methane, and tropospheric ozone will continue. This task force I just spoke about will now kind of turn its attention to methane and tropospheric ozone and away so much from black carbon. We're doing some, in the working group, some follow-up activity to the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment. The Lawson Brigham, I don't know if Lawson's here, was the kingpin of. He shepherded that that very, very well done assessment from the beginning to the end and did some excellent work. And it came out with a number of recommendations that we're now looking to follow up on in some of the working groups. The biodiversity assessment itself that I just spoke about, the trends report that came out last year, the whole assessment will be due in May of 2013, so it will be a major deliverable for the Swedish chairmanship of the Council. And a project in the PAME, the Protection of the Arctic Marine Environment Working Group, is working on in follow-up to the AMSA in follow-up to some oil and gas offshore guidelines that they have done over time and kept updated, is a health, safety, and environmental, the title is very long, health, safety, and environmental management, and the use of best operating practices for offshore oil and gas drilling. So that's a much longer mouthful of words than I should probably have attempted to say, but it'll be a very, I think, useful and timely piece of work given how much interest there is now in offshore development. Some of the new initiatives, the last slide shows sort of the ongoing work that's been taking place for a while. Some of the new initiatives that we're engaging in the working group structure are this oil spill, one of the other big things to come out of the ministerial in May that the ministers agreed to do was set up a new task force on oil spill preparedness and response. And since I've been here this week, meeting with various groups, including a group of industry representatives that Drew and Lieutenant Governor Treadwell organized yesterday, was to start talking about how the U.S. will play in this task force. And it was our initiative actually that created it. So within the council among the eight states, we thought it was about time that, given the coming wave of offshore oil and gas development, and given that we all experienced Deepwater Horizon last year, it was probably time for the Arctic states to collectively do something on spill preparedness and response, and as well as prevention, which I'll get to in a minute. So we stood up a task force of high-level people across all of our governments. The U.S. Coast Guard will be heading our delegation, which will include, I'm sure, representatives from the state of Alaska, from people on the ground in Alaska who have management and spill response expertise, especially from the North Slope Borough. The oil and gas industry will play into this somehow. We're sort of still figuring out how that's all going to work. But the Coast Guard will head our delegation. We'll have NOAA, EPA, BOMRI, various other agencies that have specific roles in oil spill response and preparedness. Oil spill prevention, though, is not going to be a part of this task force's mandate. And the task force is expected to come out with something like, possibly a binding agreement, possibly a set of non-binding standards of some kind. It's not really clear yet what will come out of this oil spill task force, but in parallel to its work on prevention and response, the Emergency Prevention Preparedness and Response Working Group, one of the six working groups of the council, EPPR, will do some work looking at oil spill prevention. And that working group has a lot of expertise on oil spill issues in the Arctic. So it's going to take a look at the picture of prevention across the Arctic states and see what's happening and if there's any common ground among the eight Arctic states, see if we can work together in any sort of way on prevention. But that work will be, will sort of advise the task force, because it's not so easy to split prevention out from preparedness and response. And we didn't want to ignore the prevention piece of oil spills, but we thought we'd put it on a separate track so that it can drill down a little bit more into the mechanics and the technical aspects of what's going on across the Arctic, and then leave the task force freer to focus on it's probably oversimplifying to say easier, but the prevention and response pieces that are somewhat less complicated, perhaps. Then we stood up, as of the ministerial meeting in May, another U.S. initiative, an ecosystem-based management expert group. The council, through the PAME working group, has done a lot of work over the years on ecosystem-based management in the marine environment in the Arctic, but we haven't done any work, we haven't done comprehensive work, I guess you'd say, on terrestrial EBM. There have been EBM facets to some of the council's work, especially in the CAF working group on the terrestrial side. But this expert group is going to look at the whole picture of ecosystem-based management, whatever that means. And one of its first tasks will be to see how each of the eight states defines EBM and how they do it in practice. And find common ground, hopefully, and perhaps make recommendations at the end of this process to the Arctic Council for how and if we should change the way we do our work and do it on a more ecosystem-based management, in a more ecosystem-focused way, instead of individual one-off assessments like the AMSA, the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment, or the Oil and Gas Assessment, or the Arctic Biodiversity Assessment, if we should maybe look more holistically in some ways at how we do our work. The Sustaining Arctic Observing Networks that I mentioned a few minutes ago, this is a new initiative this kind of has two distinct sorts of parts. On the one hand, this SEON, as we call it, will be an attempt to not change anything and not regulate anything, but to sort of bring together all of the existing observing systems in the Arctic in a way that's sort of coherent, so that they're all talking to each other, and they all know what they're doing, and you know, they can avoid overlap that way. For example, the CBMP, the Circumpolar Biodiversity Monitoring Program, that the CAF Working Group in the Arctic Council has been doing for some years now, is the biodiversity monitoring piece of the CEON. And the Arctic Observing Network that the United States is engaged in and has been for some years now will be a piece of this larger sustainable network. So that's one side of it. The other side will be to sort of link together all the existing observing stations in the Arctic. And we have a couple in Alaska here. Canada has one. There are at least one or maybe two in Greenland. There's one in Russia. And to have those actual physical stations working together a little more collaboratively. So hopefully this will work. The governance structure of it is just starting to be figured out now. I'm sure will be complicated, but hopefully will be a good and sustainable improvement to how we actually observe what's going on in the Arctic. The AMAP Working Group is doing an Arctic Ocean acidification assessment. There's been a lot of attention in the federal government in Washington, you know, NOAA in particular, on ocean acidification. And so what the council will do is look at the picture just in the Arctic Ocean and see what, if anything, should be recommended on that front. Not that there may be anything we can do outside of the climate realm, since ocean acidification is so tied to climate change, but we'll see. At least we'll have a snapshot of what the picture is in the Arctic Ocean. Iceland wants to do a second phase of a major report that the council did a few years ago that didn't get nearly as much attention as it should have, the Arctic Human Development Report. And it, unfortunately for it, was released at the same time as the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which got all of the airplay for big deliverables from the Arctic Council. But the AHDR is a very important piece of work that we will now be following up. Probably when it comes out, it'll be something like 10 years after the first Arctic Human Development Report. And then food security and access to good quality water is a new area that is of particular interest to indigenous peoples across the Arctic. It's important to everyone, but there's a lot of interest in looking at the issue of food security from an indigenous perspective on how and whether what we can do to ensure that traditional foods are still safe and available. Same with water quality in the Arctic. And I think we'll see some good projects coming from ICC in particular, the Inuit Circumpolar Council. That's going to be a new, very exciting area of work, I think, that the council will be engaging in probably for some time to come. Some things we're considering doing. I spoke a little bit this morning with the North Slope Science Initiative and John Payne about something called the Arctic Change Assessment, which is something of particular interest to Norway. And this is going to be, in theory anyway, a monster assessment of looking at the whole picture of everything there is going on in the Arctic. It's not really clear how this will come together. There's going to be a scoping workshop in a month's time in Oslo to put some structure into what this assessment can and should look at and over what time period. So stay tuned. There's not much more to say about it at this point, but it's going to be potentially a very, very large comprehensive assessment if we decide to do it. A piece of that Sweden is very interested in pursuing is on resilience. And that, too, is something that's still kind of murky at the moment. And Sweden is starting to prepare for a scoping workshop to look just at the resilience piece of the Arctic Change Assessment. So that will happen also in late September. And a new initiative from the United States that Charlene Derry at FAA is largely responsible for in the Institute of the North, and the Maritime Administration within the Department of Transportation, something, this is a long name, but it's the Arctic Maritime and Aviation Transportation Infrastructure Initiative. And this is really, really going to be a great project. I think everyone's very excited about this, to take a look at the infrastructure, both aviation and maritime, picture across the whole Arctic and see what we need to do, what should be done to improve the infrastructure up here. And I know that talk of deep water ports and land-based support for maritime activities in Alaska is a huge issue, and that will figure very prominently into this assessment. And Charlene is doing a great job pulling together this proposal, which will come to the Sustainable Development Working Group at its next meeting, which I think is in early October. So Our turn to chair is coming again pretty soon. Right now, Sweden has the chairmanship for these 2 years, until 2013. Canada will take over then, and the rotation begins. Sweden is the last country of the eight to hold the chairmanship, and then we start the cycle again. So Canada will have it in 2 years' time, and then we will follow on to Canada from 2015 to 2017. And we've been not really talking so much yet, but there's certainly some interest on the Canadian side and on our side in talking about initiatives we might want to propose for our 4 years of back-to-back chairmanships. And one place we're going to look for ideas and advice is the state of Alaska. We're going to be very interested in hearing what Alaska thinks, as our piece of the Arctic would be important for us to emphasize as a chair of the Arctic Council, and following on to Canada's chairmanship, which we hope will be coordinated well with ours. So stay tuned on that. We'll be coming back from the State Department side, and also probably Department of Interior, EPA, NOAA, various pieces of the federal government that are engaged in the Arctic. We'll be coming back to talk to people here in this state about what they would like us to do. And I think that sort of wraps it up, and I can take questions as Drew has organized how to do it.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Julie Gorley, Senior Arctic Official of the United States and U.S. Representative to the Arctic Council. Following her talk on the Arctic Council, recorded on August 18th, she responded to questions submitted by audience members.
Okay, you're going to love this. Congress has yet to ratify Law of the Sea, which was negotiated years ago. So do you see that adversity from that impending the organization operations or our ability to serve as part of the Arctic Council?
That's a really good question. We try not to get into issues, especially really big ones like the Law of the Sea Convention, the Climate Change Convention, fisheries management organizations in the Arctic Council. That's it. So we don't talk about it, the fact that the U.S. is the only Arctic state that's not a party to the treaty. But certainly it's kind of an undercurrent. And certainly in the corridors of Arctic Council meetings, we hear constantly from everybody, all the other seven countries, why aren't you there, and when are you going to be there, and what's the holdup? I wouldn't say it really negatively affects us in the Arctic at all from a diplomacy standpoint, but it certainly does from a technical standpoint. And it's kind of a mixed bag. It's not overtly a problem, but it certainly is an undercurrent.
Thank you. Does the SAR agreement mean that the U.S. is now going to fund and build more icebreakers?
Get out your checkbook, Julie.
Well, we would hope so. it's certainly something that is a lively subject of debate. Now that we're in this tremendous budget crisis, who knows? But certainly Coast Guard has been very vigilant in pressing our national needs for icebreakers, and I think DOD has been helpful there. Certainly the State Department's been trying to help. But yeah, what happens remains to be seen, especially in this huge, tremendously difficult budget climate.
But you'll do all you can, right?
Oh, yeah.
Of course you will. Interestingly, there are three questions about border dispute between the United States and Canada. The 1996 agreement to join the Arctic Council, President Clinton asked Canada to work toward deciding what our international border is. The SAR report appears not to follow the U.S. claim when you look at that map. How might that be addressed, and how might that fit into the increasing interest in trying to figure out the border?
We didn't find it necessary to align the SAR boundary with the international maritime boundary between the U.S. and Canada, because regardless of where someone is in trouble, we all need to come together and help, but we needed to demarcate for ease of knowing who should take the lead, these SAR regions. But I don't think it was, the thinking during the negotiations, which I was not a part of, was necessarily that the SAR boundary had to align with the maritime boundary, because they're kind of, well, they're different issues. That's not a very good answer, but I'm not particularly expert in this. The maritime boundary, though, between the U.S. and Canada and the Beaufort Sea, is starting to be worked on. We're, both of us, as everyone probably knows, collecting data to establish the outer limits of our continental shelves. And that same data will be used to eventually define the border in the boundary in the Beaufort Sea. And that's going to be part two after we're, you know, finished with collecting the data for the ECS, the Extended Continental Shelf, as we say. But yeah, I think now there seems to be more interest in resolving the maritime boundary, and I suspect that in a few years' time we'll be in negotiations with Canada, and sometime there will be a boundary treaty that will have to go to the Senate to be ratified. But that's many years down the road.
Question, how do federally recognized tribes factor into the council process?
They don't directly. The indigenous peoples in Alaska and everywhere are represented through these permanent participant groups, as I mentioned. They're all NGOs, including the four that have representation in the U.S. So the membership of the NGOs is key to the participation in the Arctic Council, not really so much federal recognition or not. Although how the membership of the four PP permanent participant organizations works in Alaska, I'm not intimately familiar with, but we actually have some representatives from some of the PPs here who could probably explain that better than I could. But yeah, the fact of federal recognition of the tribe or not is not it's not a factor in the acceptance of the six organizations that represent the PPs in the Arctic Council.
Oops. I've got a couple of questions I'm combining. What's been the involvement level, and how do they feed in, both of the environmental groups, but also of the industrial users, particularly oil and gas sector, but tourism and other sectors?
How do they play?
How have they played?
Yeah, there are a number of environmental NGOs that play in the council and have for some time. We actually have never had an industry organization become an observer in the council, a permanent observer. We do have the one now I mentioned earlier, the International Oil and Gas Producers Association. And I can't really say why. I think possibly it's that until recent years, there wasn't so much, wasn't as much development interest in the Arctic, so there wasn't a strong desire by particular industry groups to play in the Arctic Council. But now, of course, with oil and gas and other kinds of offshore development coming, there's now a lot more interest. I think we'll see more industry groups applying to join as permanent observers. But we do have a number of other non-industry NGOs at the table, I think 15 or 20, something like that.
And finally, do you think that some of the assessment work might lead in the future to a black carbon or a mercury treaty?
Certainly, the work of the Arctic Council through the AMAP, the Arctic Monitoring and Assessment Program Working Group on mercury, has contributed richly to the ongoing negotiations for a mercury treaty in the UN, in the United Nations Environment Program that are going on right now. So yeah, the council, that's actually a very good example of why the Arctic Council's work is so important, because it always highlights discrete issues that affect the Arctic on the global level. The Arctic Council's work contributed also to the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants, certainly contributing to the Mercury Treaty. On black carbon, it's not really clear. I don't think there's any talk at the present time about doing a regional or global treaty on black carbon emissions, but I think as the science comes in more and more and we see what the real impacts are on the cryospheric parts of the planet, it's not impossible that there could be talk of a treaty someday, but I think it's not mature enough of an issue yet to be talking about binding commitments on countries.
Once again, Julie, thank you very much for sharing with us and telling us all about the council.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Julie Gorley. Senior Arctic Official of the United States and U.S. Representative to the Arctic Council. She gave a talk on the Arctic Council, promoting cooperation, coordination, and interaction among the Arctic states, and responded to questions at an event hosted by the Institute of the North and Commonwealth North on August 18, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.